Today on Wings, Rita Wong on the poetics of water.
When we can turn the tap on and off at will, it's easy to forget the vast rhythms and cycles of which we are a part. My hope for my lifetime is to see people switch over from flush toilets to composting toilets. That alone would make me so happy.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings. There's
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service. Rita Wong is an award-winning poet and a professor of cultural studies at Emily Carr University of Art and Design. She studies relationships between contemporary poetics, social justice, ecology, and decolonization. Her work on the poetics of water is supported by the Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council of Canada. Rita Wong.
The Water Project has taken me all over the place, and I'll read you a little bit from an essay called Ethical Waters, which is a title that I stole from a book by Robert Sanford and his co-author. It's a reflection on the healing walk in the tar sands. I've been on 4 of the 5 walks, and this essay is about that. It was published in the Feminist Review in the UK. And for me, the relationship between women and water is a very strong one, as Maude Barlow so beautifully talked about this morning. I'll just read you the beginning of it, I think. For the past 4 years, I've been honored to participate in a healing walk in Alberta's tar sands, organized by Indigenous people and open to everyone who cares about the well-being of the land and water. Each summer, we have walked through a 14-kilometer loop in the middle of ground zero of Alberta's dirty oil industry in northern Canada, where producing 1 barrel of oil poisons 3 to 4 barrels of water, held in enormous toxic tailings reservoirs. We have witnessed the images you are probably familiar with by now, the industrial plants spewing smoke into the air, the wastewater tailing ponds that are deadly to all life, the moonscape denuded of trees or anything green. This walk was started by people heartbroken by what has happened to their traditional homelands. One of the early organizers of the walk, Cleo Reese, helped to start the memorial march for the murdered and missing women when she lived in Vancouver years ago. She has spoken of the connection between the murdered women and the murdered and missing waters in northern Alberta. An eerie, disturbing reminder that the violence against Indigenous women shares a logic with the violence against Indigenous watersheds. Colonization is not a thing of the past. It continues today in virulent, violent forms in both the slow poisoning of water and the fast killing of women. While the temporality and scale may shift, both enact the devaluation of Indigenous lives and ways of seeing and living. Each time, seeing the devastation to the land triggers a sick feeling in my stomach. On my own, I think I would have shrunk into despair or numbed myself because I felt incapable of addressing the huge, overwhelming scale of the destruction. Yet on this walk, the sick feeling coexists with a quietly hopeful one, invoked by the efforts of my co-walkers, as well as the many people we know who cannot make that long journey to Fort McMurray, the epicenter of that destruction, but who ask us to carry their wishes and prayers for the healing of the land with us. Perhaps you are one of the thousands or millions who would have walked with us through the tar sands if you had the means and the time to make that journey. If you had come, you would have smelled the sulfur and tar, the toxic pollution that lingers the next day on skin and hair. You would have heard the propane-powered cannons that pop to scare off ducks from landing in the enormous pools of poisonous water. It smelled like I was farting tar, inhaling it, ingesting it, and eventually excreting it, while immersed in the gaseous fumes that hovered over the tar sands basin. And I'm not exaggerating. Like, the first year that I went up on the walk, I felt like I had chain-smoked for days in a row, and I'm not a smoker at all. It left a really horrible feeling in the body just from walking around for about 6 hours in that. As Violet Clark, a First Nations elder, has said, we always had running water. We always had light. She means that what existed before the rapid expansion of industrial oil mining was a sustainable balance, a way of life that included fresh, clean running water in the rivers, as well as the use of energy from the sun. I mean, it was in the water work I've gone up north and been amazed to visit communities where people drink water right out of the river or out of the lake, or that's just not something I ever grew up with as something that was even possible in one's imagination. So when we're thinking about water, I think it's really important to not just think about treating the water, but about source water protection.
On Wings, you're listening to Rita Wong, poet and scholar of the poetics of water.
This essay is actually a collaboration with a friend of mine. It's from this anthology called Thinking with Water. One side of the page is what I'm writing, and the other side is what my friend Dorothy Christian is writing. Dorothy is a filmmaker of the Okanagan Shipukmuk First Nation, and we've been working through what it means to be in friendship and alliance in that cultural interface between Indigenous and non-Indigenous peoples. So the other thing I'll maybe mention is that my Chinese name is Wang Gamyi, and I speak sort of baby Chinese, but I'll thankfully be speaking in English today. So I'd like you to just take a moment to close your eyes and take a minute to think about the last sip of water you drank. And I'd like you to imagine where that water came from, where it was maybe a day ago, where that water might have been a week ago, maybe even a month ago. And presumably that water is in your body somewhere, and it will make its way out into the world eventually. And when it leaves you, I'd like you to imagine where it will end up, where it will go maybe tomorrow and the next week and the month after that, and maybe a year from now, where will that water be? So this essay is called Untapping Watershed Mind, and I'll just read you a bit of it. Rain teaches me to be humble. Its gentle persistence gives life to the unceded Coast Salish land known as Vancouver, where the Musqueam, Tsleil-Waututh, and Squamish have made their home for thousands of years. Thanks to the grace of rain and the generosity of these Indigenous peoples, whom I'd like to acknowledge, I live in Vancouver, which the Chinese used to call Saltwater City, in contrast to New Westminster, which was Freshwater City, part of the Stalu watershed that flows out toward the Pacific Ocean. Rain, falling steadily over millions of years, gradually gathered, pooled, and swelled into the bountiful watersheds that now provide my drinking water, Capilano, Seymour, and Coquitlam reservoirs. Rain, falling steadily over millions of years, created what the Musqueam call Stahlu, what English speakers call the Fraser River. As my co-author Dorothy Christian shows in the way she introduces herself, names matter, as they can honor a lineage and a history or obscure it through colonial amnesia. Though my drinking water doesn't come from the Stutlu is crucial to the formation of the land that I currently live on. Through millennia of silt deposits from the Rocky Mountains, traveling over 1,300 kilometers to shape the rich delta on which local farmers grew tons of produce, before industry pushed out much of the agriculture that flourished along what is now called Marine Drive. Stutlu is a 12 million year old elder, an immense force that drains a third of Aboriginal Columbia as it moves ceaselessly from its headwaters in the Rockies down, down, down to the ocean. It is a rare creature for its size, an undammed river, though some of its tributaries have been dammed with great devastation to Indigenous peoples' homelands. As a resident of Vancouver, I need to acknowledge the Saguenay people because the electricity we use every day results from the W.A.C. Bennett Dam, completed in 1967 on the Peace River, which flooded the traditional territories of the Saguenay, consisting of the Tsekedene, the Takla Lake, and Kwadacha First Nations, devastating their communities. Those of the people who lived on the 1,773 square kilometers of flooded land, and communities like the Athabasca Chipewyan First Nation, whose ability to hunt and gather was severely harmed by the dam's redirection of water, which dried up the delta they relied on for food and medicines. Saguenay families did not know that their homes would be destroyed, and people suddenly found their homes burnt down by the government. I cannot change this violent past, but what I can change is how I respond to this historical inheritance. One of colonization's common tactics is to divide and conquer different groups in the takeover and privatization of land, water, and resources. Those of us who want to walk a peaceful path have a responsibility to build relationships and alliances that recognize interdependency and love for the watershed commons on which we live. Even at this late hour, under these imperfect conditions, as Larissa Lai has phrased it. While this may be a daunting challenge, it is a worthy one, and we're fortunate to have many teachings to assist us, be they from the rain, indigenous knowledge keepers, sometimes submerged aspects of our own cultural traditions, the planet itself as its changes are translated by observers and scientists, and creatures, large and small, what Dorothy calls the seen and unseen, if we are to open a wide path of learning and peace. The dam started operating in the late 1960s and has provided BC, and in particular the Lower Mainland and Vancouver, with electricity ever since. The Tsekene have documented their history and their recent protection of Amazé Lake from Northgate Mineral Corporation's proposal to use it as a toxic tailings pond for their mining operations in their film Amazé, which testifies to their resilience and dedication to water. Their story is something I didn't learn in school, but it should be taught there. It takes time, but I am steadily making efforts to remedy my ignorance about the watershed where I live and its many inspiring keepers. For over a decade, I lived in a place made by the accumulated rain, Stakhlu, and powered by the hydroelectric dams. I remained, yet, for the most part, unaware of my dependence on the river. Out of sight, unless I was driving to the airport, out of mind. If I ate salmon, it was in a restaurant or from a supermarket, or if I was lucky, from the boat of a fisherman near Granville Island. Never had I actually seen anyone catch a salmon from the river that's famous for its salmon runs. Only this year have I actually seen salmon in the river, swimming through the Mount Curry Reserve. Such disconnection from the river is not unusual for a city person. But thanks to Dorothy Christian and Denise Nadeau, who's here in the audience, thanks to their invitation back in 2007 to protect our sacred waters, I've undertaken a journey to reconnect to the watershed in creative, practical, spiritual, and philosophical ways. Having met Dorothy at a gathering back in 2002 organized by Lee Maracle called Imagining Asian and Native Women, Deconstructing from Contact to Modern Times, I feel fortunate and honored to rethink and relearn water in sisterhood with her in an unfolding process many years later here to embark on a journey of enacting what Doreen Jensen calls laksoksinks, to be in humble, respectful proximity with each other. So I'm going to just translate or give you the definition of laksoksinks, which is a word from the Gitxsan language that means honoring and respecting others, place, and space. And I think that it may be key to the creative process and to our future. I think I'm going to, I'll read a little bit more from this essay and then I'll switch over. The other thing that I've been doing in Vancouver is getting to know my own watershed and the buried streams. Many of you may know that there are over 50 salmon streams in Vancouver that have been buried and put into sewers. And there are a number of people who are interested in daylighting them and bringing them back up or reconnecting somehow to what's there. There's a really wonderful film called Lost Rivers about this, because it's not just in Vancouver, it's almost any city you can think of has probably done that to its streams, or some of its streams. So the dominant colonial systems we've inherited run on a somewhat predictable logic, capitalist, hierarchical, predatory, exploitive. But underneath them, quietly persisting, are the watersheds and the underground streams, reminding us that another world is possible, and indeed will continue with or without us. The streams might be piped now, but unless they are painstakingly maintained, the pipes will leak and eventually burst. Before the water was piped, it was wild. What would it take for us to reconnect to that wildness? Urbanized, alienated, and ecologically illiterate, we cannot return to wilderness so easily, and may not want to, some of us. But perhaps we might explore what it means to go feral, to find some hybrid state that respects what has not been piped, controlled, and regulated, what flows as the earth, the rain, and the ocean has a power and a vitality that replenishes us. Moving in that feral direction, I borrow the term watershed mind from Peter Warshall, a former editor of the Whole Earth Review, who sees watersheds as necessary sites from which to support a cultural shift that values and substantially reconnects to water. When I walk through the city streets now, I think in terms of watersheds. Which way is the water flowing underneath the ground? Why? How much is piped and controlled and chlorinated? How much is left to wander freely? Where was the water last year? And where will it be in 5 years, in 5 centuries? How are the seen and unseen related through watershed dynamics? I also find myself turning to a member of the Earth Ministry as I explore the possibility of untapping watershed mind. Considering the critical role that primary aquifers under the West Bank play in struggles between Israel and Palestine, Doug Thorpe, who's based in Washington State, Doug Thorpe notes how in the Bible, quote, living water signifies fresh water that hasn't been controlled by human means, thus water that comes from God. But the phrase also conjures up some quality that transcends this literal definition. If you go back into history, you will find this idea that water is a sacred gift from the heavens, be that God, nature, or Mother Earth, and that people are grateful for this water. Thorpe compares us to the Roman Empire, which was also able to pipe and divert water through huge feats of engineering. He suggests that the Romans secularized the water. It no longer came from heaven, it came from Rome. But empires and governments do not make water. They can only redistribute what already exists in the living world. When we can turn the tap on and off at will, it's easy to forget the vast rhythms and cycles of which we are a part, and then slide into taking water for granted as a utilitarian resource, losing a mindful sense of connection to and reverence for the water that keeps us alive, what Thorpe calls a mystique of rain. Thorpe starts his paper by quoting a Salish elder. He says, if you take the Christian Bible and put it out in the wind and the rain, soon the paper on which the words are printed will be gone. Our Bible is the wind and the rain. And it was not until I made trips out to Seymour, Coquitlam, and the Capilano watersheds that I finally understood in a very visceral way that I drink rain every day, rain that has collected and pooled into lakes over centuries and millennia. Rain that connects me to oceans and clouds and places I have never seen with my own eyes. With the encouragement and help of watershed educator Ficus Chan, I began to imagine more of the water's path, its complex relationships to hemlock, cedar, birds, frogs, lichen, moss, fungi, and all the delicious edibles that grow in the forest. Water is a gift from the sky that trickles, dissolves into, and invigorates complex ecosystems and human infrastructures before it arrives chlorinated and resilient through my tap.
On Wings, you're listening to Rita Wong, poet and scholar of the poetics of water, presenting at the Denman Island Readers and Writers Festival in July 2014.
Okay, I'm going to read you a poem called Night Gift, and it has an epigraph that I come to through Stephen Feld and Walter Liu, and it's a Kalule saying that water is to land what the voice is to the body. And I'll mention also that it was published first in the End Pipeline anthology. I don't know if any of you are familiar with that anthology, but it's basically about 100,000 miles or kilometers, sorry, I can't remember which, of poetry that is meant to be longer than the pipeline that's proposed. It's online. All sorts of people have contributed to it. It's a really wonderful anthology. Night Gift. Make space and let the night speak through you. What will the darkness say? Will it sigh the song of night cleaners? The lament of the wrongly imprisoned? The rage of the ragged? The dispossessed? How will the night take you back? Will you be the vessel for earth shatter, hydro poison, ancestral revenge? Perhaps steady weeds growing irrepressibly into the cracks, urban repurposing, straddling both the drugs that kill and the ones that heal. The globe moves around the sun, unstoppable, feeding pine trees and the petrostate alike, giving us the days and nights by which to stand with the trees, what the oil industry calls overburden, or to die more rapidly, more stupidly by peak oil. As rivers and oceans fill with carcinogenic wastes from the petroleum plastic supply chain, The political systems follow, stuffed full of sun corpse and tired old neocolonial ego that refuses to stop growing until it reaches the limits of the planet's patience. Who knows what alliances and monkey wrenches will be enough to stop the greed of the greasy machine? What I do know is that humble migrants who've traveled the ocean have felt its wisdom more deeply than an arrogant elite that doesn't heed the world's necessary stories. Jail the stories and the G20 storytellers, but they will keep speaking the night until empire expires with or without the multitudes alive. In this race, may we be ready to move fast, yet steady enough to encompass musicians and lake gatherings, forests and gorilla gardens, fueled by a love more immense than the injustices we've inherited. We need to live the world that is possible, even while we struggle through war, respect living coasts and fluid watersheds, not murderous imperial borders. In grief and in celebration, in fear and in courage, in anger and in compassion, the night replenishes us so that we may continue to embody her songs. This poem was written fairly recently. I'm not totally happy with it, but I'm going to test it out on you guys. It's a response to the Edward Bertinsky exhibition that's on at the Vancouver Art Gallery. If you're familiar with his photographs, they're devastating. They show the mining, they show the tailings ponds, they show just the scale with which people have rearranged and reorganized and redefined the landscape. So I was commissioned to write this poem by a journal called Poetry is Dead. And there were three of us, and we did a reading around the photographs that we were responding to. And so what I'll sort of be referencing in the poem are just some of the things that I saw in his photographs, or some of the things I didn't see in the photographs that I felt like I needed to add. Okay. Too long a sacrifice can make a toxin of the earth. Oh, when may it suffice? We burn ancient sunlight and petrified ancestors like there's no tomorrow. Earth's gifts are dug and drawn so relentlessly. We arrive at a tipping point, a stranglehold. Is this capitalism facing collapse from its own progress? Ed said, everything's been touched by oil. Sure enough, I look through my plastic glasses, caught under petroleum byproduct lenses. First unwitting, then unwilling, recipient of profitable pillage, sickening scale, stunned with eerie disquiet, escalating horror pulses carcinogens every which way, brutal menace, monstrous crime scene, poison and violence leaking into the Athabasca River on its way to the fast-melting Arctic. Systemic amnesia operates on the Earth's forest green skin, cutting out life with detached sociopathic precision, overburdening pines and birches, dead ducks, canaries in the coal mine, turgid trout, delusional destruction spreads out. Explosive and erosive, manufactured discontent digs for more, more, more. Mammoth gashes extracted till abandoned, like so many arrogant American swimming pools in the desert, or Chinese dams big enough to make the planet wobble for days. Imperial deliriums race to the bottom at the expense of the watchers, an expanse of hidden relations disregarded for distraction, an immature culture pumped on blunt ambition, hydrocarbon hubris, such malignant pustules to be shrugged off by intensifying storms and quakes. Banal tyranny, drunk on God trick, devastating heists from the banks of the river, scarring the earth, scaring the unborn who hover, wondering what meets them. Two. Upon seeing her capture reflected within Bertinsky's photographs, the hostage of the petrostate renders a diagnosis of Stockholm syndrome and self-administers the necessary remedies. So terribly simple, so utterly unachieved so far, to kick the oil addiction for love of water, to inhabit the earth with the dignity owed to life-giving dirt, to fulfill our responsibility to respect all kin, to make a story large enough, generous enough to become better neighbors with the winged, the finned, the four-legged, and the stumbling two-leggeds. Another world is not only possible, she's already here, waiting underneath our feet, reconstituting us with each new sip of ancient water, reassembling us into the sacred headwaters continuum, so that we can aspire to a wiser, wider story, felt in the elders' strong, calm hands raised in Iskut. Klabona keepers hold our fate in the courage to say enough. Witness this ghastly corporate moment, striving to mature into great return, a blessed unrest like 3,000-year-old rice paddies mirroring our stars back to us, reminding us to live within the budget of what the sun abundantly provides each day. Meridians align to rebalance with what's vital, what makes life worth living. Downstream, living bodies too many to be counted, honking geese flocking overhead, wind-swayed cottonwood, magical caribou, cousins, Gaia girls, grannies, plankton, playful nieces, spawning salmon, singing mothers, mountain goats, graceful swans, steady sheep, soaring eagles, antes, howling wolves, moose, grizzly bears, swift horses, hemlock, dogs, groundhogs, nephews, fathers, blessed cedar, char, swimmers, storytellers, rivers, devotedly rising from the unseeded earth against industrial megasystems of mass destruction, committing to the union of the living, a current of spacious canoes practicing renewal with each stroke, a murmuration of ancestors and descendants soaring forth. Where the poison is found, look for the cure nearby, honoring sacred debts all the time. How do we give back more than we have taken? What better gifts can we offer? Kindred spirit, autonomous water, remembers forest before rubble, revives the forest after the trouble has stopped. So I'm struggling with this manuscript for various reasons. A good friend of mine is like, well, who is we and why do we need to do this? And I don't really know who we is. And then I started sort of just letting we speak, whoever that we might be. Who are we? We are the beings who need clean water in order to live a life of dignity, joy, and good relation. Maybe you are part of us without even knowing that you are. Maybe we are the ones who are too often taken for granted or ignored, the quiet witnesses to atrocities, greed, mean-spirited hierarchies, hostages of capitalism. Maybe we are remembering what it means to respect water, because doing so is to respect ourselves, our shared fluid vulnerability, our funny contradictions, our stumbling, dancing, crying, laughing, eating, drinking, working, playing, messy selves. Maybe we are the thunderstorms that precipitate when too much has been repressed, the weeds that refuse to stop, the coyotes, the grandmothers, the yet unborn. Maybe we are flash floods, demoralized workers, the hospitalized, the angry entitled children who don't even remember to thank the water that keeps them alive. Maybe we are system change as well as climate change. Dripping and spitting, we rise.
Rita Wong, award-winning poet and an associate professor in critical and cultural studies at Emily Carr University of Art and Design in Vancouver. Her books include Forage, Monkey Puzzle, and Sybil Unrest. To hear this and other Wings programs again, email wings@wings.org or check our page at facebook.com/wingsradio. Thank you to all our supporters, including your local community radio station, Suzette Cullen and Genevieve Vaughn, author of the booklet 36 Steps Towards a Gift Economy. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album A Circle Is Cast. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.